David Shibler is a frequent guest on this program. He reported for the New York Times from 1966 to 1988 in New York, Saigon, Moscow, Jerusalem, and Washington, D.C. He is the author of six previous books, including the bestsellers Russia and the Working Poor, as well as Arab and Jew, which won the Pulitzer Prize. He's been a guest scholar at the Brookings Institution and a senior associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, and has taught at Princeton, American University, and Dartmouth. His most recent book is Freedom of Speech, Mightier Than the Sword. It is published by Knopf, and it's a great pleasure to welcome David Shibler back to the roundtable. Thank you very much for being with us, sir. I appreciate it.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
Very nice to have you here once again. What brought on this project of looking at your thoughts on freedom of speech and where we are in this country?
I had written two previous books on civil liberties, The Rights of the People and Rights at Risk. The second one dealt with First Amendment issues. That is, we have to remember the First Amendment restricts what government can do, not what private institutions can do. And so I thought, well, there's a lot left to say about the landscape of free speech in America, because it's defined not only by the law, which is very permissive in the United States. I mean, you can say practically anything without running afoul of the government. There are ways of getting in trouble, you know, legally, but it's pretty hard to do. But culturally, it's a different landscape. The boundaries are quite complicated, and the punishments are varied, and they're informal if you cross them. So I wanted to sort of draw the map.
How, when it comes to freedom of speech, how do you believe how quickly do you believe things are moving on this?
I think things change very quickly in the cultural arena, especially. I mean, look at the revolution in attitudes toward sexual orientation in the United States. I can't think of another social issue where people's views have changed so rapidly and dramatically. And when that happens, what you get is a kind of informal protection of a new group of people against bigotry, speaking, you know, in a hateful way. And what I mean by that is that if people make comments, for example, if they say anti-Semitic things or anti-black things or anti-gay or lesbian things, they often pay some price for it. You know, they may their careers may be damaged. They may even lose a job or a promotion. I think in many companies, if you make such statements, you're not going to rise to the top these days, because there's a whole cultural shift in which people who are gay and lesbian and transgender now increasingly come under a kind of umbrella of protection. Now, there are groups that don't enjoy that protection as vigorously. For example, Muslims, I think, are kind of at the edges of the protection, so to speak. That is, some people can say things that are anti-Muslim and not face any opprobrium or retaliation. Other people do face retaliation. That's changing, and I think, but because of all the terrorism in the world and what we experienced on 9/11 and the kind of totalitarian version of Islam that we're seeing in certain parts of the world, ISIS and so forth, there's a hesitation, I think, to bring Muslims totally under that umbrella of protection. But I expect that to change too, and I think it has to some extent. And so we see these boundaries shifting all the time.
In the book, you focus on many recent free speech controversies. You tell many stories. I'm hoping that you can just give us an idea of what you were looking for in a story to share with us and to give us an idea of what our current state is when it comes to freedom of speech.
I looked at five or six different conflicts, so to speak. Book challenges in schools and libraries, an effort to prosecute leakers and whistleblowers who disclose government wrongdoing and put reporters who cover national security under pressure, the whole culture of cultural limits of bigotry, where I looked at the internet particularly as a tool for not just democratizing speech, but also spreading ideas that are not necessarily signed on to by the majority of people. I mean, anybody can set up a website, you know, and it looks good, it looks authoritative, and unfortunately, there are a lot of lies on the internet and conspiracy theories as well as good information, and it's not so easy to sort these out. I looked at the relationship between speech and money, because in politics and more broadly in discussions of public policy issues, if you don't have money, you don't really have much of a say in the debate. I mean, look at the two incidents, for example, or episodes last year when states were not expanding Medicaid as they were allowed to. Some states, about half the states, didn't expand Medicaid as they were allowed to under Obamacare. And then the efforts to cut food stamps quite severely in the Congress. Both these issues had direct impact on poor people, but you didn't really hear directly from poor people. You heard from the press when they covered the story and got people's stories, and you heard from lobbyists and, you know, nonprofit organizations that organized to help run food banks, for example. But they were basically intermediaries between the poor and the larger public, because when you're poor, you don't have the money to hire lobbyists and buy advertising or, you know, really promote particular candidates' election chances and that sort of thing. So I think that's a very serious limitation on free speech in the United States. And then I also looked at the theater as a place where controversy often, you know, creates clashes. I mean, one theater in particular in Washington, D.C., a Jewish theater where Israel plays by Israelis and about Israelis were being done, and a few very conservative people in the community were very upset about what they felt were efforts to defame Israel. I mean, these were pieces of art, these plays. They were not really efforts to defame Israel. But these folks managed to scare the Jewish community center sufficiently so that it essentially shut down what was called a Middle East festival and stopped these plays from being produced. So that's all of these are struggles on the outer boundaries of the landscape of free speech, and each one of them illustrates a different set of concerns and issues.
And in that set of concerns and issues, there are things in these stories that we can celebrate when it comes to free speech, and things that we ultimately mourn and a loss of freedom of speech.
That's right. I mean, the theater example I just gave was something to mourn, at least initially, because the artistic director, Ari Roth of Theater J, was fired in the end after 18 years of building the theater up into a very impressive piece of work in the United States Capitol, where I think people have an interest in seeing theater coming from the Middle East and hearing voices from both Israelis and Arabs. But now he has formed his own theater company, and if he gets enough money to make it work, it's called the Mosaic Theater Company, we'll actually have more speech in that sense, more theater, a broader array of plays, not just on the Middle East, but on race relations and other issues that he wants to produce, so the Washington audiences may actually come out better in that respect. In another case, I think what you saw was, in that case too, but often what you see is Americans rising up in defense of free expression. I mean, we don't really like being told that we can't see a play or read a book or have our kids read a book in school because a minority of people don't like it. I mean, and I looked in some detail at one particular school district outside of Detroit, the Plymouth Canton School District, where there was a big controversy over two novels being used in advanced placement English courses. One was Beloved by Toni Morrison, which is really one of the great novels of our time, I think. Yes. The other is Waterland by Graham Swift, a British author. And what happened there was that one of the girls in the class brought home Waterland, which they were reading first, and showed her parents a page where a graphic description of two teenagers in sexual exploration was written about. I don't think it was very erotic, but it was explicit. So the father was indignant, and he Xeroxed the page, and then he looked at some excerpts of Beloved online, and he Xeroxed some pages of Beloved, which was the next book in the course, and he took them into the superintendent of schools. And the father never read the books, by the way, and he told me he didn't plan to, and the superintendent hadn't read the books, but looking at these Xeroxed pages, summarily ordered that they not be used in the course. And teachers were called over the weekend and told to tell the kids to stop reading Waterland. Now, the kids told me later that, you know, a lot of them had found Waterland a bit boring, but once they were told they were supposed to turn it all back, turn the copies back to the book room,
sure,
it suddenly got intriguing, you know. And they read it, and even though they weren't supposed to, the local bookstore had to order more copies, and so did the library. I think the public library. So I think the best way to get kids to read is to tell them they can, of course, and you know everybody knows that. But what was interesting is that the debate in the town really divided the community along a bunch of different lines. I mean, first of all, most of the parents rallied to the side of the teachers and said, look, you know, we don't think that one set of parents should dictate what our children should read. I mean, why should they say our kids can't read these books? We think the teachers are very good and professional and can lead our kids through discussions of difficult topics. And so they came to the defense of the teachers and the curriculum. And they were basically politically liberal, I think, socially liberal. And on the other side were socially conservative and politically conservative parents. Some of them were active in the Tea Party movement. And I think that you also saw a big divide there between people who trusted the public schools and people who felt alienated from them. And I think this is actually going on all over the country. I think there are parents in other parts of the country, and I've interviewed quite a few of them, who feel that public schools have become bastions of political and social liberalism and permissiveness, and are teaching alien values or values that are alien, at least to the conservative parents. So there's a great deal of worry about, you know, losing control of their kids in the midst of a society that is inundated by images of sex all the time online and in video games and so forth. So that, you know, sex is an issue in these book challenges. Religion is an issue. I think these books were put back in the curriculum in the end, and that often happens. But in the meantime, you have these kind of local wars that go on where people, you know, really shout at each other and don't really listen to each other very well. And that's one of the things that I found in mapping the landscape of free speech in America. We can speak right very freely about just about anything, but we don't listen very well to people we don't agree with. We live in a honeycomb that what you might call kind of soundproof walls. A friend of mine called this gated intellectual communities. And I think that is a good way to put it, that there were parents in these school situations who wanted to wall off ideas that were very alien to them and to their thinking, and they didn't want their kids to be exposed to them.
You touch on this in the book, but when looking at that free speech landscape that you just outlined, do you have particular concerns, David Shipler concerns, as a journalist?
Well, I do. I wrote a whole section of the book about the efforts by the Obama administration to close down the flow of information to the press regarding national security issues. You know, there have been more government whistleblowers prosecuted under the Obama administration than under all previous administrations combined. And this has made life very difficult for reporters who cover national security in Washington, since virtually all the information they get is classified. You know, Washington has a disease of overclassification of information. And a lot of the stories that they are looking at and have written don't compromise national security. If you really dig down into them, what they do is embarrass the government. There might be a bit of wrongdoing or a bad decision or a lot of money spent for nothing and that sort of thing, which may be classified because it's being done by an intelligence agency. But nevertheless, you know, American citizens need to know what their government's up to. So I think that, you know, I talk to reporters who try to cover this area, and they use techniques that, are very interesting to try to protect the identity of their sources so they don't get compromised. I mean, for example, you know, if they take an official to lunch or out for a cup of coffee, they They won't pay with a credit card because the credit card statement can be obtained by the government. They won't use email for substantive communications. Sometimes they've even used encrypted email, although some reporters dislike doing that because they say it makes them feel like drug dealers. But, for example, Shobhan Gorman of the Baltimore Sun used encrypted email with Thomas Drake of the National Security Agency when Drake was providing her with information on the NSA turning its attention inward domestically to the United States after 9/11 and not using a program that could have separated out American citizens from others, apparently, when they were doing surveillance. So they, you know, the fact that they used this encrypted email, which was called Hushmail, was actually used by the government in its efforts to prosecute Thomas Drake. He was indicted. Shobhan Gorman nothing happened to her. I mean, they could have subpoenaed her and tried to get her to identify her source, but nothing happened to her except that she was highly regarded in the journalistic community for the stories she did. But Thomas Drake really went through the ringer. I mean, they searched his house brutally. They indicted him under the Espionage Act, threatened him with a long prison sentence, and their case fell apart when it was found that actually he had not conveyed to her any classified information at all. And basically, he got off with nothing. He pleaded guilty to a very low-level misdemeanor called unauthorized use of a government computer, and he got probation and community service, and no fine and no prison term. But this chills government officials. I mean, it's not easy to decide to go to a reporter when you know that you may end up in prison. I mean, you have a few examples of that. And reporters, I mean, it's hard to know whether reporters are getting less information because of that. I mean, logically, you would think that they are getting less and that we're learning less about very important issues from the government. But on the other hand, you still see stories based on confidential sources. Seymour Hersh just did a long piece in the London Review of Books,
right,
about the Pakistanis supposedly being involved in helping the U.S. get Osama bin Laden. James Risen of the New York Times said quite publicly that he would go to jail rather than identify a source. And he told me that as a result of that, officials were coming to him with stories and information because they trusted him to keep their names secret. So I think that's a tribute to Risen's bravery, but also the other side of the coin here. Now, it's a complicated picture. I think the Obama administration doesn't get a very good mark, though, for transparency, which is one of the things that Obama advocated as he came into office. I mean, they've been anything but transparent.
Well, the book is a fascinating exploration into the freedom of speech. The title of the book is Freedom of Speech, Mightier Than the Sword. It is published by Knopf. David Shipler, always a pleasure to have you on the program. I thank you very much for sharing with us this morning.
Well, thank you.
Great pleasure. Thank you. Again, Pulitzer Prize winner David Shipler, his new book, Freedom of Speech, Mightier Than the Sword. It is published by Knopf. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.